Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine if you turned on the radio and heard a news story about an American coastal town that was actually at risk of being washed away by rising sea levels. Imagine further hearing that people there are thinking of abandoning their homes and their town site to head for higher ground. Well, you can stop imagining. This is actually happening. Not at the scale that's likely to have CNN scrambling cameras into action, but people on the northern Alaskan island of Sarychev are now asking the government to help them plan a permanent evacuation. I read about this shrinking island in a series of pieces for The New Yorker, written by the staff writer Elizabeth Colbert. Elizabeth is here this hour, and we'd like to have you join us as we talk about those visible effects of climate change. Are you watching global warming where you live? Do we need to see the effects of climate change before we take the problem seriously? And in a time of war and an uncertain economy, just where does climate change fall on your radar? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Elizabeth Colbert is joining us now from a studio in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Where exactly is this Alaskan island, Sarychev?
It's off the Seward Peninsula in the Chukchi Sea.
Okay, I still don't know where it is. If I imagine Alaska on a map, is it north of the state itself?
The Seward Peninsula sort of sticks out of the west side of the state towards which was where there was a land bridge during the last ice age.
Yeah.
So right there where right across to Russia, very close to Russia, in fact, when you're there. And it's right off of that, a couple miles off of that.
Now, one of the characters who you talk about in your writing is a fellow by the name of Tony Wiawana. He's in the village of Shishmaref. And I had a chance to speak with him yesterday about just exactly what he's seeing.
There's quite a few changes. One of the things that I've noticed is the rise in the water level. You know, when I was a kid, we used to have a nice long beach to play baseball. So we'd have 150, 200 foot beach to play on. But nowadays our beach is very narrow, maybe 20, 50 feet. And, our kids can't play down on the beach like we used to.
What about the wildlife and birds and things like that? Have you seen any changes in, what you see in the neighborhood?
One thing I noticed is that we have a lot more different birds than we used to when I was growing up, We're seeing different birds such as robins, camp robbers, those kind of birds that never used to come up here. Another thing we're noticing, too, is we have a lot more bugs around our town than what we used to have. For example, when I was growing up, we, didn't really have any dragonflies, but I noticed in the last couple of years, we have a lot of dragonflies around.
That's the voice of Tony Wiawana. He's a resident of the town of Shishmaref in Alaska. He's a character in a three-part series written for The New Yorker by Elizabeth Colbert. The series is called The Climate of Man. I'm interested, Elizabeth, when they talk about actually having to leave the island, is this speculative at this point, or are they watching the water coming up and saying, no, we're really going to have to go?
Well, what's happened in Shishmaref is that the fall is storm season up there, and the sea ice used to come in earlier in October and November, and that protected the town from these very serious storms that come in the fall. And now the sea ice comes in later, so the storm comes up, and when a really bad storm comes up, it will literally wash away part of the town, and that has happened on several occasions in recent years, so that they have had to move houses that were near the shore, and the island is extremely narrow. You could walk across it in about 5 minutes, so washing away part of it is a pretty serious thing. So it's not really speculative. I mean, it's quite likely that Shishmaref will simply disappear. I don't know exactly how long that will take, but that is probably in the foreseeable future.
Now, your travels also took you to Fairbanks, Alaska, and a look at the real estate there, which caught my attention. Tell me what you saw.
Well, Fairbanks is located in what's called a region of discontinuous permafrost, which means that if you dug under the ground, you would find In some places, there's permafrost, which is simply means frozen ground, and in some cases, there is not. And in the areas where there is permafrost, it's reaching, a lot of it is reaching the thawing point. So it's basically, you know, the water in it is melting, and that causes a variety of different problems, one of which is you'll sometimes see the roads simply cave in. And I went to a few places where these holes open up, and they're just basically, you could fall in there, you know, 5 feet deep. They're just basically a hole in the ground.
And it's because a piece of permafrost or ice water that's a part of the permafrost has just melted.
Yeah, and as that water melts, you know, it's sort of, you can imagine it's sort of held the ground in place, as it were. And as that water starts to, you know, percolate away, the ground basically just collapses.
So when people are shopping for a house in Fairbanks, will they actually say to their agent, is it built on permafrost?
Well, the guy that I traveled around with, who is an expert on permafrost, he told me very specifically that he would never buy a house on permafrost these days. And I think increasingly people are saying that to their realtors, because if you travel around Fairbanks, you can see a lot of houses that have fallen in and or are tilting over. They're sort of listing as if, you know, in a storm.
Now, tell me why this isn't just a cyclical thing. I mean, you know, we have 5 or 10 warm years and a couple of neighborhoods in Fairbanks warm up a little bit and the houses fall in and then it'll just get cold again. Why is permafrost a useful thing to look at here?
Well, permafrost is useful to look at because it takes a signal, a variable signal in the air, and it sort of puts it through, they would say, puts it through a filter. So it gives you long-term climate trends. But the permafrost alone, you know, wouldn't tell us that this is not just climate variability. What tells us that is a combination of things, one of which is, you know, basic physics, basically, the physics of, you know, putting more carbon dioxide into the air. And that was predicted, you know, over 100 years ago, that if you put more carbon dioxide into the air, you would warm the planet. Combined with empirical, you know, observations all over the world, and most specifically with rising average global temperatures, which are reaching, you know, record levels year after year now.
There was a number, I'm trying to remember it, from the measure of melting permafrost, something like some of this permafrost may be melting for the first time in what, like 120,000 years?
Yeah, it's hard to date the date of permafrost, but this permafrost expert whom I traveled around with, who is from Russia and who's a great guy, he estimates that most of it in Alaska has been there since the last glacial cycle, and a glacial cycle takes about 100,000 years. So if it were to thaw, it would be thawing for, he thought, the first time in about 120,000 years.
Elizabeth, is this your beat? Do you always cover climate stories, or the series Climate of Man, was this your first sort of in-depth exploration of what's really going on?
Yeah, it was really my first, you know, it's something that interests me and, you know, concerned me just as a citizen. And so it was really a tremendous education for me, too, during the series.
When you look back over all the different places that you went and what you came across, would you say that you wound up confirming what you feared or learning stuff that you didn't know before you started?
Well, I definitely learned things that I didn't know before I started. And I think one of the things that I found most compelling, there are two sides of the science of global warming, and one of it is the theoretical science, which people don't really have that much exposure to, and the other part of it is this, you know, going out into the world and actually seeing the effects, and both are very, very compelling.
When you say theoretical science, you're saying this is not what you would see, you know, in Shishmaref or in Fairbanks.
Yeah, it's calculations that people have made, and as I mentioned before, they made them over 100 years ago. A Swedish chemist, a Nobel Prize-winning Swedish chemist, made these calculations, surprisingly sort of accurate calculations of the effects of increased CO2 more than 100 years ago, and people have basically, you know, been refining those calculations for the last 100 years.
You went on a long drive out of Fairbanks and found yourself in the middle of forest fires, which is not something that I would necessarily have thought. Did that surprise you?
Well, it was very surprising. I mean, when I arrived in Fairbanks last summer after a record-breaking forest fire season, the air was so smoky that it looked like evening. It always looked like evening, basically, even in the middle of the day. And you could, you know, this sort of smell of burning, sort of burning rubber hung over the city. And people told me that I wasn't even there for the worst of it. It had been much worse. But forest fires in Alaska are very much something, increased forest fires are very much something predicted by models of global warming because of increased evaporation and the soil drying out.
And do the people who live there, Elizabeth, draw a straight line between those things that you're describing from us and climate change, or is there still a debate?
Well, I think there's, in Alaska, you know, just like in the rest of the country, there is still a debate among, you know, people on the street, as it were, although I should emphasize that there really isn't a debate in the scientific community anymore. But people in Alaska are very conscious of it in their daily lives, and you see increasing numbers of people, including very, you know, sort of conservative politicians, growing very worried about what's happening to Alaska.
Connection listeners, are you conscious of changes that you see in the climate around you? Is that what it would take for you to go, oh, well, maybe this is something that the nation needs to deal with? Or are you happy listening to what it is the scientists are telling us in theoretical terms about the risk to this planet, to our grandchildren, from the kind of climate change that is being talked about? Why is it so much on the radar of countries everywhere in the world and not here in America? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join my conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Elizabeth Colbert wrote a three-part series for The New Yorker called The Climate of Man. She is my guest this hour. We're talking about what she saw in the way of climate change and asking you to join us for the way that you're looking at it as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm taking a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Janet's with us. Hi, Janet.
Hi.
So, what do you see?
Well, I want to thank Elizabeth, first of all, for this very compelling series. I think it really captures on a human scale the effects of what we're facing, as well as providing some of the science for a layperson like me. And I guess what it makes me think about is I have been conscious of these things for a while. We try and live with a relatively small ecological footprint. I drive an old Honda Civic for environmental reasons, and yet it's increasingly clear that this isn't going to be solved through recycling, through the sorts of individual actions like I and my family and some of my neighbors do. And I guess I'm left feeling, what can one person do?
Or can one person make a difference? I know what you're talking about. Elizabeth?
What should I be doing? We need a survival.
Well, I think that, you know, that's a very good point that you raise. And I think, you know, many of us, you know, sort of many people are asking that same question. And I guess I came away with two thoughts from all this, one of which is, you know, everything that you can do. I mean, on some level, the only solution is, you know, acts of people, all individual people multiplied by, you know, 6 billion. But on some level, it's also true. It's not going to be solved by recycling. There is no one sort of solution to global warming. It's not like, you know, turn off your lights and you'll solve global warming. The single most important thing, I think, is to elect people to the leadership of this country in particular, who see and acknowledge and the importance of this issue and are willing to take action. It is a very, very difficult political issue. We see basic silence out of Washington these days. And so I guess if I could identify one thing, it would be the importance of electing people and making sure that our, you know, elected leaders realize that we do want action, and we will support action, and we, you know, demand action.
Was it your conclusion at the end of your research for this, Elizabeth, that the United States is increasingly standing alone here in not providing that kind of political leadership?
Well, it's not, you know, my conclusion. It's sort of you know, just an objective fact of life.
No, but you spent time in Europe. You saw what's going on in the countries over there.
Absolutely. I mean, the Kyoto Protocol, which is sort of maligned in this country, but which is the first step towards controlling greenhouse gas emissions and is an international treaty, was approved by every industrialized nation in the world, except for the U.S. and Australia. And Australia, I should add, has said that even they would approve it if the U.S. would just approve it. So we are really the only industrialized nation that is not basically moving forward and saying, yes, this, we realize this is a problem, we need to address it. And that's pretty astonishing. I also should add, we produce nearly a quarter of the world's carbon dioxide.
But in those countries that you visited, you were also talking with people who had changed their lives, or towns that were adapting to climate change in ways that, I don't know if you'd agree with me on this or not, Elizabeth, but it seems that people in America have not made that kind of adaptation. So it's one thing to say, you know, there may be a significant lack of political leadership here, but there's also kind of a corresponding lack of civil engagement on it as well, isn't there?
Well, I think those are completely related, you know, and it sort of goes back to what we were just talking about. Since we're not seeing leadership from Washington, we have to basically demand that kind of action. And if we don't do that, I really don't know, you know, what's going to happen. And I think that people in Europe, and I think what you're referring to is I took a trip around the Netherlands, and people are extremely conscious of global warming in the Netherlands, as you would expect, because they are in such a vulnerable position, both to sea level rise and to changes in precipitation, which they're also expecting. So they are expecting a great deal of flooding. And in that case, the government has a whole ad campaign basically telling people, look, the climate is changing and we are going to have to do things to take that into account.
Describe one of those TV ads for us.
Well, the TV ads that I saw, if they featured a kind of local celebrity weatherman, and in one of the ads, they were funny. They were sort of dark comedy. And in one of the ads, he's sitting on a beach, and he says the climate is changing, sea level is rising, and as he sits there over the course of these 30 seconds, the waves come up, and until at the end of the ad, he's sitting still on his beach chair, but now he's up to his waist in water. And there are several of these ads that ran in rotation.
I'm not sure how to pronounce the name of the town. Maasbommel, is that right?
Yes, Maasbommel. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the houses there.
Well, they've built some what they call amphibious houses, which are houses that are on the edge of the Maas River, and when the things are normal, the houses are basically on the riverbank, and then when the river floods, and river flooding is something the Dutch are very worried about, the house will rise up. They're sort of on pontoons, and they will rise up. And the company that is manufacturing these homes, and they are not cheap, I should point out, is hoping to, you know, sell them basically around the world, or use them as a prototype for sales around the world, because they really think that flooding is going to be a tremendous issue in the coming decades. And, you know, they're probably right.
1-800-423-8255. Now to Nashville, Tennessee. Aaron's on the line. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I have a comment about why I think that more Americans, and conservative Americans in particular, are not so keen on the whole matter of global warming and why we're not that interested in it. I have an ongoing debate with a good friend of mine who's a PhD chemist in Pasadena, and I tell him, look, the reason that people who are conservatives like me in particular don't pay a lot of attention to this is because sometimes we see this as a part of the broader spectrum of sort of environmental movements on the left that include more radical elements such as the animal rights movement. Whether you like that or not, there are a lot of us that are turned off by that. And we also see a lot of people who really push the global warming agenda also as being politically anti-capitalist. And we, to be honest with you, it's a turnoff. Now, he's talked to me a lot about the science of these matters and said, look, don't listen to the radicals, don't listen to the activists, listen to the scientists. I think the problem is that the radicals are the ones, and I don't mean to be offensive, but the people who turn us off as conservatives are the ones that have the megaphone and not the scientists. And I think the scientists need to take center stage and really get their message out and take that megaphone away from people who are otherwise offensive and turn off conservatives.
It's interesting, though, Aaron, you still speak about it in terms of a sort of a political issue where you can choose to pay attention to it or choose not to pay attention to it. Is that reasonable?
No, and I don't necessarily mean that that's my perspective. What I mean is that it is. I see it being, at least in terms of the way the debate is takes place in the public, it is more of a political debate. It needs to be more of a scientific debate, and I'm afraid that the politicians and the people who are more radical and have other agendas, such as an anti-capitalist agenda or an animal rights agenda, all these other things that turn us conservatives off, they are the ones who control the debate and control the message, and it's not the scientists. I think if the scientists control the message, people who, all people, would pay more attention to that. And I don't mean that for myself, but I think to ignore it.
I mean, Elizabeth, you would find probably very little debate within the scientific community at this point.
No, and I think it's an important point that's being raised here, and I think that the political, you know, quote unquote debate or divide of a global warming in this country, you do not see in Europe, for example, where, you know, the president of France, who is on the center right, you know, has talked about the overwhelming importance of dealing with global warming. So you don't see it as a politicized issue over in Europe very much. And the notion of scientists sort of controlling the debate, you know, unfortunately, that just isn't the way politics in this country works. I wish it were. And I agree that I think that scientists, and I think increasingly the scientists in the field feel this way too, they need to speak out. But it's hard to be heard above the clamor. And I should say, you know, while there's clamor on the left, there's a lot of clamor on the right, you know, denying the science. And that has served to obscure the issue as well. So I think that it's absolutely true. We need to listen to the scientists, and anyone who is listening to the scientists, as our caller, you know, pointed out, his friend in Pasadena, is going to be pretty alarmed.
Those clamoring on the side saying that global warming, climate change is not happening. I mean, has that now been put in the category of junk science, nonsense?
It's getting closer and closer. I think to be fair, you know, there are a lot of the world is a very, very complicated place, and the interaction of, you know, natural climate variability, of all of the many biological systems that affect climate, those are very complicated things to sort out. So it's only been, you know, fairly recently in recent years that the scientific community has said, yes, we see a very clear fingerprint of human-induced climate change, and we feel confident enough to say that. So in that sense, you know, it took a while for the scientific community, which is, you know, very, very conservative and very skeptical, and I say that in a good sense, obviously skeptical and really in making sure that all the evidence is in. But in the last several years, most people in the scientific community would say, well, the evidence is in, and we need to do something.
Let me go back for a moment to Aaron, if I can. Aaron, when you're talking with this chemist friend of yours in Pasadena, let's assume that he or she says, you know, this really is bad and we can't seem to get people talking about it. What would you say? How would you change the debate so it isn't a whatever it is, left, right, red, you know what I mean? You know, how do you make it more about what's really happening rather than the sort of it being hijacked by the fringes?
Right, and I think what you can't do is to make those people on the fringes, make those people that get exercised politically. You can't make them be quiet. That we don't do that in this country. And I hear you guys and myself saying that we need to listen to the scientists. I think the problem is that the scientists they need to speak up, and not just in journals, and not just in lectures, and not just on university campuses. I think that together they can get together and they can get our attention. They need to grab that megaphone from the fringe movements,
yeah.
And I think, to be honest with you, that should distance themselves from those fringe movements. I think that they need to distinguish themselves from those elements, because honestly, it's not the science, and it's not some sort of aversion to being willing to believe that this is happening. I think it's that we conservatives are turned off by those fringe elements that are linked with it, and I don't mean that the scientists link themselves necessarily. I think that some of those fringe groups.
Let me, Aaron, go back to Elizabeth on this, and just Elizabeth, did you hear from within the scientific community any of what Aaron's saying that in fact they could be doing more, find a way of getting their message across to more people in a more effective way?
In fact, you see, you kind of hear exactly the opposite, and I think, you know, I think Aaron's point is well taken in many ways, but what you actually hear from them over and over again is, we present the science, and the politicians have to make the choices, and that is all we do. And when you, you know, read what they write, it's really often very, it's impenetrable to a layperson, and that is what they are comfortable doing. They are not comfortable you know, ringing the bell and saying, ringing the alarm and saying, you know, we must take action. They say that is a policy decision. I'm simply telling you what the risks are. So they don't want to do that. That is not what they feel the role of science is. And I think that the problem is that when they go to Washington and tell the policymakers this, it does tend to divide up in terms of right-left. But I also want to say that many people on, you know, in the red state category are becoming increasingly concerned, and one of the leaders in Washington, really perhaps the leader in Washington on this issue, is Senator John McCain.
It's interesting, though. I turned on my radio this morning and listened to a story about an EPA report saying releases of toxic chemicals into the environment fell 6% in 2003. And then you get further down in the story, and the report says, although there were fewer facilities reporting their pollution findings compared to recent years. I mean, it's one of those things where if you do, in fact, just let, you know, the people who write news releases for agencies in Washington tell a story, you may not be getting the straight goods.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. Although, if you look on, you know, on the sort of websites of our major research agencies, the NOAA, NASA, the EPA, you will find a tremendous amount of information about global warming, and basically a consensus that global warming is occurring right now.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Milford, Massachusetts. Melissa's with us. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
So, tell me what your thoughts are.
Well, you had asked whether, you know, personally we had seen any evidence of global warming. I've lived in Douglas, Massachusetts for 21 years. It's right on the border of Mass, Connecticut, and Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a joke with us when we, the first few years we lived in the house, that we had frost right up until the first week of June all the time, and we'd get a frost by the first week of September all the time. Well, that never happens anymore. We don't get a frost usually after May 15th, and we didn't get a frost like last year and probably until October 1st. I've just seen a dramatic change in the climate as a whole. You know, on in horticultural circles, we've gone from a zone 5 to a zone 6, basically, which is huge.
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yes, that's absolutely right. The USDA redrew the zone maps in the states, basically in response to climatic change. It is now, you know, we all live in a zone, different zone from what we lived in 30 years ago. And any given year, you know, the frost date can move around, but the basic trend towards, you know, later frosts in the fall and, you know, an earlier frost-free date in the spring, that's also, you know, well documented. And then the caller's absolutely right. That is happening. The seasons are shifting in that way. And that is, you know, quite likely a result of global warming.
And Melissa, I'm wondering if there is a little perverse part of you as a gardener which goes, well, it may be global warming, but it's actually not bad because my tomatoes are in the ground a little bit longer.
Well, no, it is true that, like, I'll try plants that I wouldn't have even tried 20 years ago, you know. I wouldn't have risked them, you know. But another caller had asked what we can personally do, and lately I've been reading about some things that, for instance, it's some sort of a heat exchange thing using geothermal, because, of course, below the first 4 feet of ground, it's always 55 degrees. So apparently it costs only about $8,000 to put in one of these systems. And, of course, raising your house from 55 degrees to 70 in the winter is only a 15-degree change instead of raising it from 0 to 70.
Melissa, I need to stop you because we're going to take a short break. But I'm glad you raised the question of using these kind of geothermal heating and cooling, because it is an opportunity for us to talk about the kinds of changes that people can make and whether or not people really are interested in investing in, you know, solar energy and the batteries and all the money that is required to make these kinds of differences. Do people believe that what they do on their own makes a difference? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Elizabeth Colbert's piece in a series of pieces in The New Yorker are called The Climate of Man. It is her travels around the world looking at different places and different times in history that bring us to a better understanding of what is exactly happening with climate change right now. It was certainly enough to convince Elizabeth that what's going on is something that people need to pay a little bit more attention to than they are right now. We'd like to hear where you are on this issue. We're at 1-800-423-TALK to Louisville, Kentucky. And John's with us. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm a conservative American, and as I'm listening to the show, you know, I'm a parent, and I'm certainly someone who's concerned about the environment. But you know, when you have items like, say, the Kyoto Accord, and where the United States was in that particular situation expected to bear the brunt of things that other countries were not expected to in order to make a global change, and also, you know, and looking back over, you know,
can I ask you though, just to sort of look at that in a broader sense with me, John? Though, if every country always said, "Why should we do this? Our neighbors are not being forced to do it." Does anything ever get done?
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily, at least from my point of view, that's not necessarily the way to frame it. To where, if we were expecting Kenya or some other type of country that had certainly fewer resources and or certainly weren't impacting the global climate change in the way that I would imagine that we are, that would be unreasonable. But for countries like China and India and others, they're certainly in a situation where they should have to abide by the same exact principles that we are, just because of the nature of their impact on the problem. And, you know, one of the things that happens, I know, at least with my wife and I, because we're both concerned with this, is that when you get into situations where you talk about the Kyoto Accords being just one that I threw out there, you know, when there becomes a debate and people take sides, and there is a right and left nature of that, and then it's hard to tell what's true. And, you know, since I've been alive, I'm in my mid-30s, there have been a lot of things that I remember being told in grade school that would certainly happen. Everything from mass water shortages to shortages of wood, to where I was trying to explain to my children the other day what killer bees were, since when I was a kid, I told that Texas would be plagued with them by the time I was in my late 20s.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this, John, is, and I'm going to turn it over to Elizabeth. I'd like you to stay with me, if you would, for a minute. But when Elizabeth writes about this, what she's writing about is, on one hand, what we see and the decisions we make based on what we see, and then what we don't see and the faith that we have to put in the scientists who are telling us about that, Elizabeth. It's kind of hard to square those two in a way.
Well, I think that is the big problem that we face, and that is the really key thing to keep in mind about global warming, and I think that the caller makes a very good point. It's well taken. There's sort of a fatigue. You know, when I was growing up, we did air raid drills, and we were going to be all blown up, you know, by the Russians. So there's a fatigue with sort of global apocalypse and, like, what's the latest global apocalypse. But I can only say that global warming is something that you gets built into the system, and it doesn't manifest itself for several decades, and that is well known. The reasons for that are well known, and it has to do with the inertia of the climate system. So the things that we're doing right now will basically determine the climate that our kids and our grandchildren will live with. And that is a very, very heavy responsibility. If we wait around until we decide, well, global warming is really getting, you know, it's too hot even for me to deal with, it's going to be too late. We're going to have set things in motion that will truly be catastrophic, the melting of the Greenland ice sheet and things like that. So we do have to be forward-looking, and we do have to put faith in the in the scientific community. If we don't, then we really are basically fading our children to tremendous problems. And in terms of, you know, why is this catastrophe different from all other catastrophes, I can't, you know, really answer that. I can't answer, you know, why there were predictions of global famine that haven't come true. I can only say, you know, as I think a pretty skeptical-minded person myself, that I talked to these people, and not really one of them voiced any doubt that we had better do something, or we could face very, very serious problems.
John?
I could. If I, you know, I think it at least from my point of view, that it's more than just credible scientists, because it would have to come down to credible politicians as well, and that to get it done and to make the change, which, again, I'm a conservative American, and I would have no problems, both my wife and myself, of being a family behind some real changes. But the credibility, not just from the scientists, but from the politicians, who are so right and left on this, it's hard to tell what is true and what's not true.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, as I think we talked about before, there's certainly something to what you're saying, but there's a bill, a very important bill in Congress right now, which, you know, isn't going to get passed, I should mention, but it's called the McCain-Lieberman bill, and it would make some very important changes. And, I don't think anyone would say that Senator John McCain is on the left. So I think that it's not, you know, really a right-left issue. There are a lot of people, you know, on the right who are very, very concerned about this issue. In terms of their credibility, you know, I can't personally improve their credibility, but they are out there, and I certainly would recommend, you know, looking on John McCain's website, because it's an issue that he is very, very concerned about. I spoke to him about it. I mean, he's very eloquent on the topic.
One of the points that I found changed my own perspective when I was reading some of the research that you had done on this, Elizabeth, is that in the back of my mind, when I think about global warming, I sort of had graphed it from, you know, warm now to warmer in 10 years and warmer in 10 more years, and, you know, in a kind of a straight line going up from left to right. But when you talk about the effects on the polar ice cap and how the the reflecting feature of that much white on the top of the Earth would be replaced by darker water, that's when you get into the tipping point part of this. And I hadn't really thought about it reaching a point where global warming could, in fact, accelerate rather than just, you know, move slowly up over the centuries.
Right, and that is the, you know, what scientists refer to as non-linearity, and that is very real. There are a lot of feedbacks in the climate system. There are some negative feedbacks which would take, warming and dampen the warming. But so far, the feedbacks that that seem to be predominate are positive feedbacks. And that means that, you know, the more the planet warms, the more it will warm. And the feedback that you identified, which is the melting back of the polar ice, is a very, very significant one.
1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina. Gary's with us. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I'm pretty familiar with this particular issue because I work for the Air Pollution Control Agency here. And one of the things that we run into is, I mean, we probably understand it about as much as anybody else because, I mean, we deal with the whole air pollution issue every single day. But we see both sides of it. We see the industrial side and the regulatory side, but mostly it seems to come down to two things. One, people don't know what to do, and two, people just don't really want to, give up or what they perceive they're going to have to give up. And we're probably in a better position as a group of people to understand this and put this into a context that, the public could understand.
Are you a scientist, Gary?
Yeah, I'm an engineer.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if a little earlier in the program it came up that maybe the scientists, engineers, people like you need to do more to, you know, blow the horn, get people who aren't paying attention to pay attention. Do you see that as your responsibility?
I actually do, and I actually go out and teach seminars on these sort of issues. I mean, it's something I've been doing not just recently, but I took it on quite some time ago. But again, it's kind of like there was a mention of the fatigue factor, which of course you do get, and then it's kind of like, well, I don't really want to do that. I don't really want to give up, you know, what I've had to do. Nobody can see the connection between, you know, what's been going on for the last 100 or even for the last 50 years or since World War II, when we went from one type of society to another, and they can't see the connection that we actually have this huge impact. It's just kind of slow in showing up. So it's really difficult, at least I find very difficult, to convey it beyond kind of a small interest group and people who are really activated by this, but to try to get other people kind of, you know, lit up and involved, and all, they just don't seem to. There's too much other stuff going on.
Anything, Elizabeth, in places that you went that taught you how that change came about, how you went from, you know, informed people going, we got a real problem, to society going, and so we should do something about it?
You mean how that transition take place? Well, I do think it comes back to, and I think, you know, that the caller is absolutely right. It's very, very hard to motivate people for things that, you know, are going to happen tomorrow. And it's really, really hard to get people worked up about things that are going to, you know, might not manifest themselves for 20, 30, 40 years. But I think that, and that is why I think it gets back to leadership. People probably aren't spending a lot of their time worrying about the fate of, you know, Social Security. Now the administration has decided to take that on for reasons that, you know, I'm not going to go into right now, and that people can speculate about. But if the administration and administration chose to take on global warming, I think that people, because I think that there is a vast and among liberals, conservatives, centrists, a lot of anxiety. There is a lot of concern that people have. Most adults have kids in this country. Mm-hmm. I have kids, and we are worried about the future that we are handing to our kids. And I think that if someone were to take that leadership role, they would find, I hope, that people would respond to that. I don't think it's going to come. You know, it gets back to, can it come from people? And it's not coming from Washington, so I would urge people to demand that it come. But I'm not sure that it's going to come that way. And it's very, you know, when you look at it, it's hard, as the caller pointed out, you know, it's hard to be heartened by the situation.
Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia. Scott's joining us on the line from there. Hello, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm a builder in Charlottesville, Virginia. And, you know, I base my building practices on the three R's: reduce, reuse, and recycle. You know, when you go about building something like a house, there are so many ways that you can reduce waste. You can reduce the amount of fuel and energy that the house will consume with better R values. You can have things like geothermal, radiant floor heating, passive solar, you know, just how you set the house on the property. You know?
Does it make it a lot more expensive, Scott?
Well, actually, sure, that's the problem. And if we would start to tax people that don't build with these properties, or tax, you know, in Europe, every product that they sell, I think in Germany, you have to have a way to recycle every piece of that product, and if it's not able to, then you're taxed for that when you sell that product, and you're also taxed for the packaging.
Do you find, though, that there are people in Charlottesville who are willing to pay that premium for radiant floor heat or a little bit of solar assistance or something like that, even without the assistance or the incentive?
Well, I do believe Charlottesville, you know, is a unique area, and there are environmentally conscious people and people that are a little more aware maybe than other areas of the South. And, you know, right now I am spec building a house that is based on all those features, but I also, you know, have had a lot of interest and a lot of people, you know, very excited about what I'm doing. So, yes, I think it's there whether or not they'll pay the extra, you know, to have a house that's, you know, updated and modern, and be able to see that in the long term, you know, their fuel bills, energy bills, et cetera, will be a lot less, and it'll pay itself back. You know, it's just having people thinking more than just for today, and really, like the Native Americans believe, you know, think seven generations down the road, and then you're probably on track. But, you know, as far as global warming, I studied that in college, and most big shifts that happen in environmentally and in evolution, there's a slow progression upward, and then there's a huge shift, and then it plateaus. And I think we're about at one of those big shifts. I don't think there's anything that can be done to stop global warming. The oceanic currents are already shifting.
What do you think, Elizabeth? Are we there now? Is doing something at this point going to change that?
Well, I think that that's... you know, there's a risk. There's definitely a risk that we're in the danger zone. And as the caller pointed out, climatic shifts, the climatic record does suggest that they happen very, very fast. And so it's entirely possible that we've put enough CO2 in the air that we've, you know, set up one of those shifts. But it's also entirely possible that we have time to avert, you know, the worst worse effects. And one would certainly think, if one thought that one's children's future was at stake, that one would take a very, very conservative view and try to do everything possible, you know, to minimize those risks.
In some of the historical research that you did for the piece, you talk about the curse of Akkad, I think if I get that right, excavations from an Iraqi dig, which show that, you know, there have been tremendous climate changes in the past, droughts and things like that, right?
Yes, there absolutely. I mean, you know, every kid knows, you know, there's been ice ages. So definitely there have been, you know, very big climate changes in the past. And what people have discovered now looking back over the last 10,000 years, which geologists refer to as the Holocene, which is our current interglacial period, after the last, you know, glaciers receded from, you know, on top of Boston. And in that period, which has been a quite stable period climatically, even in that period, there have been moments of pretty significant climate shifts and that have produced, you know, different effects in different parts of the world. But that particular event, which occurred about 4,200 years ago, produced a very large drought in the Middle East. And you can see a lot of civilizations, our archaeologists are increasingly seeing that a lot of civilizations reacted to that. And in the case of this particular civilization, which was known as Akkad, it collapsed. It was an empire, and it basically went into collapse.
You see that as a warning, the sort of thing that Gary was talking about?
Well, I think that the warning from that is that even relatively minor, I mean, in terms of climate history, that was a relatively minor event. Even relatively minor climate shifts can, you know, wreak havoc with civilization. And when you start to think about how we depend on the climate, it's in multitudinous ways.
Elizabeth, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. She's the author of a recent three-part series called The Climate of Man. Earlier on the program, we talked with Tony Wiawana, who lives in the town of Shishmaref in Alaska. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.